Inkstud CITR 101.9 FM. Actually, I don't think this song's going to be played on the radio. So it'll just be Inkstud.com. part of my month-long focus on Canadian cartoonists. The person I'm talking to right now. You're Canadian now, but your
I'm
heritage...
I'm a new Canadian by choice.
Canadian by choice. Why, Miriam Levicki, why don't you tell people your... Your countries of origin, multiple.
Yeah. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, which is where I was born. After high school, I went to Israel, got citizenship there, stayed on for 4 years, joined the army. After I did my duty, I came back to the States. A year after that, I moved up here to Vancouver. And last week, exactly a week ago, as of this recording, I got my Canadian permanent residence. So... Thank you.
Welcome to Canada. If
I'm able to apply for citizenship in another 2 years, then I'll have triple citizenship. And
bam.
Then I'll just, you know, collect them all.
Collect. Put them in Mylar bags.
Yeah.
There we go. Backing boards. Dust-free. Archival quality.
Indeed.
Can you still vote in the States?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, permanent residence, I don't know, it might be complicated with citizenship that they might try to make me give up one, but as of now, yeah, I can still vote, although when I voted in 2004, there was an official news story about how Ohio was not counting absentee ballots. Oh. So I was like, thanks a lot, Ohio. Because it was a swing state. It went red in 2004, I believe.
I love the way that starts. It went red. It's like they're a bunch of communists.
I wish. That's why I moved to Canada, for the communists.
They're called socialists.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Or as we like to call it, the New Democrat Party.
Mm-hmm.
Good old NDP. Can you vote in Israel?
I can, although in Israel they don't allow absentee voting, so I actually never have. Because every time there's been an election come up, because they get called really fast over
there.
Well,
they have,
it's like Italy.
Really complicated.
Yeah.
Political system, like it's
and it keeps changing, like whether the prime minister is just the head of the ruling party or whether you vote independently for the prime minister. Like that's changed at least once in the last 10 years, and elections get called, you know, in a snap. So every time there's been an election and I've been eligible to vote, I've actually been out of the country on a trip that I scheduled before the election was called. So I've actually never have voted in Israel, although, you know, if another one happens this year, I might try to just fly there for the occasion.
Well, I guess going with that, your comic Jobnik, you were on the show, I guess, what, 2 years ago?
Something like that.
It was a while ago, back in the early days of the Ink Studs, when I was even more socially awkward than I am now. Your comic, Jobnik, is about your time... It's autobiographical about your time in the Israeli army. And I'm hoping we don't do the same thing right now. We're not going to. We're going to talk about your other stuff. But tell people about what Jobnik is, and also, like, the odd way that your political viewpoints after the experience... kind of work with. I just asked about 10 questions there, so just pick whichever one you want.
Well, it is mostly a personal story. It does center on, you know, the one character who is based on me and her romantic foibles and various things like that, but there is the... it was a very politically fraught time that I'm writing about, you know, not that there aren't a lot of those in Israel. But I joined the army in August of 2000 when there was a peace process, and then in September of 2000 there was no peace process. And so it was after like 6 years of negotiation and, you know, kind of this, you know, kind of tense but coexistence going on. There was suddenly violence and suddenly, you know, crackdowns and, you know, all these Palestinians who had been working in Israel and working side by side with Israelis were suddenly, you know, trapped in the territories and under curfew, and all these, you know, suicide bombings were going off almost unrelentingly. And so that's the undercurrent of this story. And it's kind of how it affects the characters and also doesn't affect the characters, you know, how dumb teenagers will have their dumb teenage drama even when there are things that are much more important going on. So that's part of it. I did want to humanize, you know, Israeli soldiers, which doesn't mean, you know, make them heroic. You know, I don't think they're heroic at all. Like I said, they're young people who are, you know, selfish and dumb and just generally like young people are, but, you know, they're not monsters and they're not heroes, and but I do think it's kind of in that way, I think it's pro-Israeli in that it's just showing Israelis as human beings, not that, you know, they don't do horrible things, but
now, military service, you know, is kind of obligatory.
Right. I ended up volunteering because I got citizenship after I turned 18. So I did volunteer, and that's why they decided that I was insane. No, literally, it's like, you know, the catch-22 in catch-22 is if you are crazy, you don't fly missions, but if you want to fly missions, it means you're crazy and thus are not qualified to fly missions. But if you claim you're crazy, that's a very sane thing to do, and thus they make you fly missions. You know, that's in the book Catch-22. So it was basically like that. You know, I felt like because I volunteered for the army, I was too insane to serve any challenging type job.
So, ergo, the title, Jobnik?
Jobnik, yes. That is Israeli army slang, and it means basically someone with a desk job, someone who is not important. And it's been interesting going to Comic Cons. I meet a lot of military and ex-military people, which are sometimes my favorite people to meet because, you know, we can compare experiences. And so I always ask, like, what is the word for Jobnik? And I guess in the 70s in Vietnam, the term was Rempf, rear echelon motherfucker. and now it's like, I think it's Pogue. I'm not quite sure. Like, as in the Irish group. I might have that wrong, though.
Well, the Irish group was originally Pogue Mahone.
Right, right.
Which means kiss my ass in
yes.
Gaelic. So.
Yeah.
If I got it wrong, I'm very sorry.
We're going to get lots of angry Irish callers. And lots of, you know, U.S. military who are going to tell me that I'm wrong.
Yeah. So Jobnik is about your personal experience in that time, but it takes... I guess it's gone, what is it, six issues now?
Yeah, six issues.
Now you're getting more close to the present time. How far are you going to take the series? Because you're, where the story is now, you're not in the army.
No, that is incorrect.
No?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was just my first leave, my first scheduled leave that I took is at the end of this book. You get like a week of leave every 3 months or something, and then if you're a soldier who's, you know, from a foreign country and doesn't have family in Israel, you can get extended leave, and sometimes they'll even pay for you to fly overseas to see your family, and that's what I was able to get, and so I had 2 weeks of extended leave, and so I chose to fly to Toronto in February.
Because you know, it's anywhere to go in February. It's Northern Canada, well, Northern Canada, but Central Canada.
Yeah, absolutely. But on the, I'm actually back in the army. I guess other people have been confused about that also, that I am back in the army at the end of the book.
Okay.
And so it's actually, the Jobnik book is about, chronologically it's the first third. I'm not saying that it will be a perfect trilogy, because I don't have it that well planned out yet, but it's definitely going to continue.
What do you see yourself doing once you've kind of told your story?
I really don't know, because it's taken me 4 years to get the first third of it down. So, you know, hopefully it's not another 10 years, but it might be another several years, and so I really don't know where I'll be at then. In the meantime, in addition to Jobnik, I do enjoy doing these drawn essays, which I had just one of, I guess, last time I was on the show, and I've done a few more since then.
Pow, Zap, Boy.
Right, that's the newest one.
Which I'll get into just a sec.
Right.
I just want to talk, you've done a lot of work in your recollecting of Jobnik.
Yeah.
Like, since you've done the separate issues.
Yeah.
What's so special about the collected edition? Other than having a spine.
Right. It has a spine, which is very nice. You can put it on a bookshelf and know what it is without taking it out. It's six issues, and the first three issues, so the first half of the book, is completely redrawn by me in the last year. Jobnik was basically what I learned to draw comics for. Like, I didn't draw comics until I started this story. And so it really took me a while to learn how, basically. And my style changed, and I got better at composition, and I switched from doing pen and ink to doing soft pencils, and so it was really a pretty big difference in drawing style that happened over the course of the comics, and I really did want it to read as a novel rather than as a series. You know, in One Direction, it's, you know, interesting to see the changes an artist goes through, but you know, in a novel, it's also, I thought it was more important for it to be cohesive, for it to read as all, you know, that you shouldn't be too aware that, you know, it's a person drawing this and going through changes as they're drawing it.
Mm-hmm. You're saying pencil, the specific choice of doing the art?
Just because I never really got comfortable with pen and ink. Like, when I would do sketchbook, like, my sketchbooks are always just in pencil, and, you know, I like erasing things, and I don't have, like, a bold, confident line, and I never really learned about line weight and cross-hatching. And, you know, at first I was like, oh, well, that's how comics are, and I'll just pick it up. But I didn't, and I was, you know, too impatient to say, I'm going to do, you know, a year of practice before I start drawing my story. So I just kind of went back to what I was comfortable with. And it definitely does have drawbacks, because my pages get so dirty, and they're kind of impossible to keep clean. And so I do a lot of photoshopping, and it still comes out looking really grubby, and so I, you know, I pretend that's my style.
Let's give you a little duster. A little paper duster. So, Pau Zap Oi, that's your, a comics essay you've written about the role that, Jewish cultures played in autobiographical comics.
That's right.
A good way of stating it?
Yeah.
So what do you think it is about Jewish culture that is so profound on autobiographical comics? Because in the thing, a lot of the artists you talk about aren't even Jewish,
right.
But you talk about the impact of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you hear people talk about, you know, storytelling and the importance of storytelling in Judaism, but, you know, that's true in many, many cultures. So I think maybe, at least what I'm putting forth in the essay is probably the most Jewish thing about autobiographical comics is the tradition of psychoanalysis, which was, you know, invented by a Jew. Because I really think that, I mean, I guess there's Jung as well, but I don't know that I could point to many autobio comics that show the, you know, fingerprints of Jung as much as they show Freud and, you know, things like childhood traumas and, you know, the necessariness of...
It's a little more easy to grasp than...
Right. I mean, maybe some of the trippier artists. You probably could do an autobio comic in the Jungian tradition.
Maybe Elvis Roeder.
Right.
Bald eagles.
And so, you know, that was one of the main points, is that, you know, most Western autobio does seem to come from a sort of Freudian perspective, and kind of the need to air dirty laundry and stuff like that. And also, you know, another very important theme, I think, of, you know, Jewish tradition and Jewish storytelling is the importance of, you know, having joy in sadness and having sadness in joy. Like, that's worked into many of the Jewish holidays, and I think the sort of, you know, bittersweet...
Like Passover being so violent, but such a wonderful family get-together?
Right. Well, you know, Purim is the biggest holiday, where it's, you know, it's kind of like the Jewish Halloween in that, you know, children dress up and... all adults are supposed to get roaring drunk, and, you know, you make these food baskets and give them to each other, and it's, you know, it's the happiest holiday. And it's about how the Jews were almost killed out as a people, and so there's that, but also at the end of the Purim story, the triumph of the Jews is when they kill all their neighbors. It's like, they didn't succeed in killing us, but, you know, by the way, we committed this big massacre, now let's all eat. which is slightly problematic. But just the idea of, you know, like, really sad books that are full of humor, or, you know, being really happy but being neurotic that things are about to go bad, you know.
Personal juxtaposition, I guess.
Right.
So, some of the major influences you cite, I mean, there's the obvious, the Eisner and the Spiegelman. One that you really cling to is Justin Green.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about his work that identifies with that Jewish culture where he is so profoundly Catholic?
Right. Well, he definitely, you know, kind started off confessional comics, you know, most people acknowledge that, but I found it interesting reading Binky Brown that it's not a huge part of it, but it's definitely a part of it there, is that Binky Brown's father is Jewish, which I believe Justin Green's as well, and he's, you know, he's very palpably shamed by the fact that, you know, his father is a heathen. And whenever his father appears in the same panel as some sort of issue of theology, like if he asks his father, do you believe in heaven, then suddenly, instead of looking like this regular, you know, working Joe 1950s guy, his father has, like, this Star of David on his forehead and horns and like a black Mickey Mouse nose, and so it's kind of this personification of, you know, the antithesis of good Catholicism, I guess, and that this leads to, you know, it's an additional source of shame for Binky Brown, and, you know, shame also being a big part of the graphic novel tradition, you know, I thought it was very pertinent.
When you first started doing autobiographical comics, did you realize the historical context of them, or is it just something you discovered later while getting more into the comics world?
Right, right. Well, I mean, I was always a fan of Will Eisner, but I don't think I really connected what he did with what I was doing at first. I think I'm just an exhibitionist, you know? I like talking about myself. I just kind of did autobiocomics because that was the story I had. Like, that was the easiest for me. But I was thinking, I guess the original idea for this essay, for why I wanted to do this essay, was because I was kind of thinking about the consequences of autobio, like the times I've gotten in trouble or was afraid I would get in trouble for, you know, telling other people's secrets. And how, you know, it's not just yourself that you're exposing, you know, necessarily in autobiocomics. It's usually other people also. And so I was thinking of, you know, precedents of that sort of thing, of, you know, suffering the consequences of exposing other people in print and, you know, who's done that and who's, you know, dealt with it. And that, so my first artist that came to mind was actually Philip Roth, who is, you know, a novelist and not a graphic novelist either. And just sort of like he had this big flap with his ex-wife when he wrote this very thinly veiled character, and then she wrote like a revenge memoir, and it was like these dueling memoirs. Of,
the pen is mightier than the sword.
Indeed. Or the divorce lawyer. So I was very interested in that, like, what do people have to say about that conflict? And being ethical while being autobiographical, you know, is it possible? Is it something you should care about at all? That's kind of one of the places where the essay grew out of.
Now, what do we have to look forward to in the future from Miriam Lubicki?
Well, the essay is coming out in a Rutgers anthology called The Jewish Graphic Novel Critical Approaches, I believe is the title. And so it's all different essays on Jews in graphic novels, a lot of, you know, Eisner, Johann Sfar, and those type of people.
John.
Yeah, I know. It's as if he's Spanish or something.
Johann Sfar.
So that's coming out. Even though I wrote the essay like a year ago. Graphic novel, as we said, I'm gonna keep doing Jobnik stories, and I'm gonna keep doing drawn essays. Like, I've got an idea for another one now, and I just have to kind of start the research on it. Just everything's been taken up with getting the graphic novel perfect.
So, people that may want to see it, you will be in Vancouver, you'll be at Comics and Stories at the end of the summer, August 24th, Vancouver Art Gallery.
That's right.
It'll be fun! Kim Knight will be there. As well as
San Diego Comic-Con.
And then how about APE. Do you go to APE?
Yeah, going to be at APE, and this is the first year I'm going to be at SPX as well.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah, I've never been.
Everyone say hi to Miriam for me, since I won't be there. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Miriam. And I look forward to more JavaNet, because I love it. And I think you all should check it out, too. What's the website?
The website is www.realgonegirl.com. I'm currently feuding with my webmaster, so if anyone out there wants to be a webmaster for cheap, you should contact me.
Cheap meaning t-shirts and books?
Yeah, that'd do it. Perhaps some original art.
Oh, they are nice pages. I've seen them. Thank you very much, Ruth, and keep listening for more Canadian interviews, folks.
Man, I'd rather work in the foundry than put fishes in a can. I'm 35 and I haven't traveled far, and I've spent all my money on this misbegotten car. I'm up against it all, like a leaf against the wind. Against the wind.